Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's summertime, and even though many of us no longer have school holidays, it still feels like a time to sink into books.
It's like kind of injecting pure entertainment chapter after chapter.
That's why today we are bringing you the best of the best, our top three fiction and our top three non-fiction books published this year in the Times and Sunday Times 100 long list. Some will sweep you up in the storytelling, others will tell you things you never knew you needed to know.
The Beatles wanted to make a Lord of the Rings movie. They wanted Stanley Kubrick to make it. I think Paul was going to play Frodo. John Lennon was going to play Gollum.
You're listening to Stories of Our Times. I'm Stig Abel, in covering for Man Veen. Today, what to read this summer. In the Times building, there is a small room tucked away in a hidden corner. It's filled with books, stacks and stacks of them, colourful, teetering. And there I went to meet two people with pretty enviable jobs.
I'm Robbie Millen. I'm the literary editor of the Times.
And I'm Andrew Holgate. I'm the literary editor of the Sunday Times.
So the literary editor job sounds lovely. Is it lovely, Robbie?
No, I'm actually going to agree with Andrew there. We like to disagree about some things, usually the kind of the quality of Hilary Mantel's prose.
Oh, should we get on? We can get on to that later.
No, let's not get on to that.
But no, I feel very lucky to have it. It is one of the best jobs. It's like having a library, a constantly updating library at hand all the time. So if you ever someone mentions a book, you can pick it up and give it a 20-page read and think, ah, this is fantastic, or cast it aside.
And do you like, Andrew, the fact that you can back a book? Do you like championing books?
I absolutely love it. It is the biggest thrill of the whole job, actually. So one of the books we're going to talk about soon, Meg Mason's Sorrow and Bliss, our critics went completely mad about it. And so we were able to give it a huge amount of space, do lots of stuff around it, and it got to number 6, I think, that weekend in the Amazon bestseller list.
And that's, you feel you've done that?
Yeah, it's essentially, yeah.
And Robbie, the Times is occasionally known for going after books as well. Is that an important thing? Because some people believe everything should be cozy, you know, books are all beautiful things and everyone's tried their hardest and therefore you shouldn't really be too mean about them.
No, occasionally you have to shame the publishers because sometimes they do produce terrible books. They're essentially like a herd. They kind of all chase the same thing. So you think, do we really need this 20th book about wild swimming? So occasionally you have to say, no more. But then occasionally they just publish just terrible, terrible books. Someone in the organisation should have said no.
Well, let's not get into wild swimming because I'll be thoroughly agreeing with you on that. It's a blight on broadcasting as well. Let's talk about this list then. How did you create the list? How did you get to 100, Andrew?
Some people think that we read every single book. Obviously, we don't. We have to rely on our critics. So this is going through the list and seeing which books our critics particularly loved. There will be some input from both of us who would have read a lot of the books, but it's books that are published either in hardback or paperback this first half. And it's books that we think would be good for some reading. There are some tough reads in here, and there's one by Sam Bias, which I think you have to have a strong stomach for that, but a novel. But generally, it's books to give pleasure.
Are these beach books we're talking about here, Robbie? Are these books that you want to read uncomfortably lying down with sand entering your crevices? Or maybe you're not even going to get to the beach at all this year, so maybe it's a different category altogether.
No, I think we're using it in a very kind of loose way. Because otherwise beach reads do kind of sort of, you assume it's kind of some kind of flim-flam. Although I hope that there is a bit of kind of light flim-flam
here. There are light books.
Yes.
Nothing wrong with flim-flam. Life is full of flim-flam.
But do you know, one of my favourite beach reads, in that I read it on a beach, was Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, which obviously takes you through Stalingrad, all the misery of those times.
I can't believe you're pulling out a Russian Brit book as your beach read.
That is utter twat.
Yeah. I find it difficult when I took all the Proust in the original French, but I did.
No, but I was lying by a Greek pool, and I was in the coldness of sort of the Russian steppes.
Do you want to outdo him there?
No, we've done an additional list for Sunday of 14 books, classic books. I can almost guarantee that will give you pleasure.
Well, give us a couple of those.
Will be Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. I've never met anyone who's not enjoyed it. And also Sons and Lovers by D.H. Lawrence. Again, I've never met anyone who hasn't loved that. Both completely engrossing books. I'm slightly nervous about Sons and Lovers because I read that once when I was about 19, but I'm pretty sure
It will have aged well. I'm always terrified when I go on holiday of not having enough books. And I don't have a Kindle. I don't really want a Kindle. So what I do is I always carry about 9 books for a week's holiday.
Well, exactly the same as you. I always take far too many books to cover every single eventuality, just in case, and every single mood.
Or you could just take giant Russian books and then you never run out then, do you?
The year before last, when there was still a holiday, I did take Dostoevsky's The Idiots on holiday.
Oh,
and
really?
I found, actually, no.
Number 3 on the non-fiction list is Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West by Catherine Belton.
This book is a scathing attack on Russian corruption. So scathing, in fact, that she is in trouble because she is being sued by various members of Putin's inner circle. And it's a very, very serious situation. But she's a really dedicated journalist and she's written a very, very strong book.
If you want to sort of understand the modern world around us, this is an extraordinary piece of reportage. The amount of years of research, this does feel definitive, and it takes you from Putin's early day as a kind of KGB spy in Dresden in the 80s, and you realize what a kind of almost complete non-entity he was and how he was groomed into power. So, you know, you think this man's been prime minister or president of Russia for 22 years. And this just explains how this a small cadre of KGB officers, when the chaos of the Soviet Union collapsing, they made some really strategic decisions, created almost like a slush fund of money to keep their networks alive. So while chaos was engulfing the old Soviet Union, they were ready to take power. And they've done a good job of maintaining power.
And in some ways, it's one of the issues of the age. I mean, we constantly, find this on the radio, you're talking about Putin, how he got into power, how he clings onto power. And whenever there is some obscene act globally which leads back to Putin, there's the hand-wringing, there's the commenting in the West, but nothing ever seems to happen and he sails on onwards, doesn't he?
Well, I think this is one of the points of the book, the extent to which Western banks and financial institutions have gone along with basically kind of state-mandated theft in Russia. There's a lot of people in the West, lawyers and PR companies, as well as banks, that are sort of directly benefiting from this kind of current sort of kleptocratic regime. This is not a beech read that's going to cheer you up. Your vein on your forehead will be throbbing with rage by the end of it. But sometimes you need that.
Non-fiction book 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time by Craig Brown.
We all know about Craig Brown. He's a wonderful writer. He sort of had a first go at this book when he did his book on Princess Margaret, which was a series of snapshots of her. 99 glimpses, even. And this is very much the same about the Beatles. So I think there are 100 sort of mini chapters on them. Some of it is very funny. Some of it is very poignant. There's a bit where quite early on, for instance, where he goes on a tour around both Lennon and McCartney's house. He goes on some sort of ridiculous tourist trail around their houses. So he approaches them in a lot of different ways and makes it feel very, very fresh.
He almost should have been awarded a prize for bravery of writing a Beatles book. I mean, it's an overwritten error, isn't it, Robbie? This could have been awful and pointless because it's so well documented. And to find a new way at it is quite an achievement.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is really a good beach book because you can sort of read a chapter between mojitos. It doesn't require a great deal of concentration. It's it's like kind of injecting pure entertainment chapter after chapter. And I discovered all sorts of things in it. I hadn't realised that the Beatles wanted to make a Lord of the Rings movie. So they actually bought options to make it. They wanted Stanley Kubrick to make it. I think Paul was going to play Frodo. John Lennon was going to play Gollum. But J.R. Tolkien hated their music. So he put a kibosh on it.
Thank God, in a way. That sounds like a bit of a sort of 60s drug thing, isn't it? McCartney as Frodo's Kubrick directing. I'm not sure. Could the world have handled
and
that?
And George Harrison as Gandalf. Move aside, Ian McKellen. George Harrison's in town.
I've read bits of it, and it is universally loved. Not all of the books you'll choose in this list will have beautiful writing in them. And you have great confidence in Craig Brown. He knows how to turn
absolutely
a phrase, doesn't he?
Absolutely does, yeah.
Number one in the non-fiction list, Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illnesses by Suzanne O'Sullivan.
Facial expressions inadvertently reveal my opinion to others, even when I don't intend it. It doesn't seem a stretch, therefore, to suggest this embodiment of a person's inner world has the potential to extend into illness. That the body is the mouthpiece of the mind seems self-evident to me, but I have the sense that not everybody feels the connection between bodily changes and the contents of their thoughts as vividly as I do.
I really loved this book. So Suzanne Sullivan, she's a hospital neurologist, so she knows what she writes. And it's basically about what we might call psychosomatic illnesses. I think the more technical term is functional neurological disorders, which sounds a little bit dreary. But it's really about how your mind can make you sick. This is basically like a travel log of sickness, because she travels to loads of different places to find out these various examples of psychosomatic disorders. So, for instance, in Sweden, hence the title Sleeping Beauties, there was this strange occurrence of asylum seeker children falling to sleep for months, even years on end. It's called resignation syndrome. Their life is so depressing, they put themselves to sleep. And the only known cure, and it sounds ludicrous, is when their parents get a successful asylum application and then they slowly wake up. Doctors can't find the physical cause. So this is, we think, just one of those moments when the mind, in order to cope with extreme situation, creates these kind of physical symptoms. In Colombia in, I think, 2016, there was this mass outbreak of, I think, what we would call hysteria amongst teenage girls. They'd all had the HPV vaccine. And the end of the first day of all these vaccinations, 50 of them had been hospitalised. Some of them ended up in wheelchairs. And it's really just a reminder of how little we know about how our mind works and the mysterious things it can do to us. I mean, it's a very compassionate book, because it'd be easy to say, well, these people are fakers, they're making it up. But she shows that actually you have no control over what your mind is doing.
And it sounds a bit like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel or something like that. When you're reading a lot of non-fiction, has it become permeated with fictional technique, do you think? Is that the way that non-fiction has gone? Because it seems to me there's two possibilities. There's the sort of the fictionalisation, the novelisation of scene setting. There's also the introduction of the author, often the eye.
Yes, there's a lot of that.
In non-fiction. Are you seeing any themes with all this?
Biography in particular has definitely moved away from the thudding, he was born on, he died on, and here is every single thing he did in between done in a linear fashion.
There's a lot more I was searching through the attic and I came across these pages.
So there's quite a lot of the authors themselves now introduced. There's quite a lot of snapshots, very much in the way of Craig Brown. Of course, we've had an explosion of memoir in the last 5 or 6 years. You know, everyone wants to write a novel. Your first novel is always about yourself. These people have made the sensible decision to do it as non-fiction rather than as fiction.
Speaking of fiction, we'll be moving on to look at the fiction top three, but first, a message.
Hi. Poppy Damon here, the editor of the Stories of Our Times podcast. The news, the views, the analysis, the investigations, the exclusives, the interviews, and the business. Get more of the Times and the Sunday Times for less with 50% off a digital subscription for 6 months. Sale now on, and it ends June 29th. Subscribe today at thetimes.co.uk/storiesofourtimes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Andrew Holgate, literary editor of the Sunday Times, kicked off our discussion about The Passenger by Ulrich Alexander Boschwitz, the number 3 book in our fiction list, although he did have a confession to make.
Neither of us have actually read this, so there's total transparency. But our reviewer, David Mills, absolutely adored it. This book was actually first published in 1939 by a Jewish-German writer, Ulrich Alexander Boschwitz, and it's a sort of a Buchan-esque 39 Steps tale about a Jewish man on the run inside Germany, taking one train after another and getting a sort of precarious sense of freedom as he moves from one place to another, but constantly feeling as though he's just about to be nabbed. And it was written by Boschwitz just after Kristallnacht, in a few weeks just after Kristallnacht. He then escaped Germany. He went to Australia after having been in England. On the way back in 1942, sadly, his ship was sunk and he died. But David Mills, who's read Hans Vollard's Alone in Berlin and Sweet Française by Irene Nemirovsky, both of which are rediscovered novels from the Second World War just before, he says this is better than both of them.
I love John Buchan deeply, and so the idea of a bit of plot, I like it quite. This is a genre novel, is it?
Yes, it's a sort of a thriller.
I am actually looking forward to reading this because I love those kind of Eric Ambler novels from the very late 30s, early 40s, things like Journey into Fear, which I think would have been published at the same time, or The Mask of Demetrios, the rise of Nazism, being caught, you know, in real time, yeah. I think does add a real kind of extra sort of sharp note to thrillers.
Joseph Roth, I suppose. A bit. We're getting more literary there.
Well, you can take that to the beach to sit alongside Robbie.
Oh, yeah, Robbie will take it. Have you ever taken any Joseph Roth to the beach?
I have, actually.
Have you? He's very good, though.
He is excellent, excellent.
No, Andrew?
It's not my thing. I have to confess, I've tried 3 or 4 times.
Oh, no.
I've tried the Radetzky Marsh.
So good, the Radetzky.
I know. You know, there are certain books, we get to about page 45, and you think, I'm just not going to make this.
And also, it's you, not them. And you've just got to say, my job isn't to beat my head about this.
Yeah, I think so. I would recommend to anyone having problems with reading a book, put it aside. Enjoy yourself. Yes. Don't feel a sense of duty.
Don't just read to show off.
No, honestly, there's a good 30-page rule. If it's not caught you in the first 30
Although,
pages.
I would have to say for that, 100 Years of Solitude, for instance, by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, that takes 45 pages and you think, what on earth is going on here? And then suddenly you are completely swept
I'm
up.
I'm reading that exactly the right age. I read that when I was sort of 15. I just suddenly thought, why aren't all books magical realist books? Why aren't they all like this? Why aren't all this giant quilt appearing and stuff like that?
Again, that's another book I'm slightly nervous about going back to, but I'm sure it will hold up.
Patrick asked me if I would consider making friends in Oxford. Even if I didn't want to, and I was only doing it for him, he didn't mind. He just didn't want me to start hating it too soon. He said, at least until we've unloaded the car. He said, you don't have to get a job straight away either. If I said there weren't any jobs anyway, I'd already looked. Well, in that case, it makes sense to focus on the friends thing, and maybe you could think about doing something else work-wise if you wanted to, or, I don't know, do a master's. In what? In something. I screenshotted a picture of Kate Moss in a fur coat, ashing a cigarette into a hotel topiary, and said, I'm thinking about retraining as a prostitute. In the middle of overtaking a van, Patrick shot me a look. Okay, first, that term isn't used anymore. And second, you know this house is in a cul-de-sac. There won't be the foot traffic.
Meg Mason clinched the silver spot in our top three fiction books with her novel Sorrow and Bliss. And when it comes to actually reading books, it's a case of all or nothing with our literary editors.
Well, I've read this.
So have I.
Oh, good. Good.
Go on, Rob, you start.
Someone sort of described this as Fleabag meets Patrick Melrose.
Quite a good description of it, actually.
Yeah, usually I sneer at those kind of, it's X meets Y, because usually it's, no, nothing's like Tolstoy meets 50 Shades or whatever. But this actually gives a good flavour of it, because like the Patrick Melrose novels, it's about a rackety, quite posh family with all their kind of sorrows. And it's got that kind of witty, sharp tone that Edward St. Albans has in those Patrick Melrose novels. And it's also got that Fleabag tone, because it's also about a relationship between two sisters, one of whom's a bit flaky, well, more than flaky. She suffers from some kind of mental illness. It's never made clear. But it is actually very funny, because, again, we're talking about beach reads, and you kind of think, do I really want to read a novel about depression on the beach? And you think, yes, this is what fiction's for, because it's funny, sharp, really well observed. I can't think of anything else to say.
No, I think you're right. Did it kind of come from nowhere? I mean,
Sort of. Every publisher jumps up and down about their lead books, and they were jumping up and down about this. But earlier in the year, I hadn't really clocked it at all. And it's in the bestsellers this weekend, actually. I would thoroughly recommend it. It manages its quite depressing subject matter really astutely. It's not laugh out loud funny, but there is a wry, funny tone to it, and it's actually very warm, and you're completely on the side of this rather completely dysfunctional character who is struggling with two husbands, one of whom is rather sympathetic and the other whom is a complete ogre.
Well, this is one of the funniest descriptions of someone. Her first husband, she describes how he had a room for his drum kit with a mirror in front of it. And you kind of think, what a devastating criticism of someone, that they drum in the mirror so they can see themselves.
You totally believe it, can't you?
Yes.
She writes very well as well. And she's clearly very, very astute. There are perceptions about people and about situations that you think, oh, yeah, that's absolutely bang on. I'd thoroughly recommend it.
And for your number one, you've gone for a plucky little underdog that you want to give attention to. So well done to you both for this. It's important to, I think, give attention to people who've been neglected by the canon over the years.
The thing to say about this...
It's not very brave of us, is it?
No,
joking aside, Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro has earned its place in our fiction top spot. Andrew Holgate was keen to explain why.
The thing to say about this book is that there is a curse of the Nobel, which is that anyone who wins the Nobel Prize for Literature never writes another good book. And this is Kazuo Ishiguro's first novel since winning the Nobel. And it's a very, very good book. It's a book about an AI machine, a robot, essentially, with some form of sentience, who is learning about the world and who is given as a companion to an ill young girl. And it manages to have lots of very intelligent things to say about sentience and about being human and not being a human.
More so than Ian McEwan did, perhaps.
Much more. The thing about Ishiguro as well is that he thinks things through. It's thoroughly realistic. It's set quite near future, and it's beautifully done. If there was an author who had the best endings, I think Ishiguro would be up there, actually. And this one has the most poignant ending about a robot. And you think, how has he done that?
Whatever he may or may not be, he's not a predictable novelist. You can't read his previous one and think, well, the next one he's going to do is going to be about an AI robot teaching a girl. Each one of his books seems to me to sort of almost come from nowhere each time.
Well, I like the fact he's willing to raid the dressing up box of genres. Yeah. So this one, you can see, he's drawn a little bit on sci-fi. He's not, obviously it's not space algae or anything like that. Likewise, The Buried Giant, he was willing to sort of draw on a bit of fantasy. He's written things which are almost like not quite chase thrillers, but thrillerish.
He's written one of the most beloved novels of the 20th century, potentially, as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely, Remains of the Day.
I mean, people will say Remains of the Day. People will put that on a list, won't they, of top 20.
Yeah. The two most successful novels he's written are The Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go.
Yeah.
Never Let Me Go is about a bunch of students who are waiting to be farmed, essentially. Yeah. And this book is very much an amalgam of those two
books.
And It really is. Because, so Clara is a sort of a person who's waiting round on other people, very much like in Remains of the Day. But there are sort of science fiction elements to it as well. And it's extraordinary.
When we were new, we used to worry that because we often couldn't see the sun from mid-store, we'd grow weaker and weaker. Boy AF Rex, who was alongside us then, told us there was nothing to worry about. That the sun had ways of reaching us wherever we were.
It's a very, very good book. Lots of different levels. And just as a read, actually. I mean, there are things that will puzzle you in the book because Clara is trying to work out the world and some of the ways she works out the world are very puzzling. But I think it'll make you think, and it's very poignant.
It's one of those novels you pick it up and you immediately think, I'm in safe hands here.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Straight away.
And that's really important, isn't it? Because there's nothing worse than the stubbed toe when you sort of, about sentence six, yeah. And you think, oh, God, and then you're on edge.
And I think it passes the Robbie Millen, Valerie Grossman test of you being able to lie on the beach with a book that is setting out to impress other people and actually enjoy it at the same time.
You can ask for no more when it comes to your beach read. Should we talk about that reading over the last 15 months? Because I suspect for some people, I probably count myself in this, reading has been really very important as an escape. I found I've got into genre fiction even more.
Absolutely.
I found the how encouraging and consoling it is to read things with a clear plot, which have an ending, which are resolved. Yeah. Has your reading changed, both of you, over the last 15 months, personally rather than professionally?
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't get enough dystopia. You know, it was depressing outside. I thought, let's make it depressing in the house by reading as many dystopian novels. So I went through a kind of 2 or 3 month phase when I was just reading sort of mid-20th century British dystopian novels. So things like John Christopher's The Death of Grass, about some virus wiping out all the grass and people start starving and turning against each other. And then Day of the Triffid by John Wyndham. I mean, they've aged a little bit, the dialogue's a bit creaky, and probably the characterization of women, not much effort was put in. But they're cracking stories about what happens when society breaks down. And then J.G. Ballard, loads of J.G. Ballard. Brilliant stuff. High Rise was one of the books I read. I just thought, yes, I just want to read about people turning on each other, but written with this immense, fertile imagination.
Probably shouldn't explore too much the psychology behind that, Robbie, but commendable honesty there.
I had a disastrous 2020. I almost stopped reading, actually. Don't tell my editor.
Yeah. I kept
starting books and just thinking, oh, do you know what? This life's too short. So I actually had the completely obverse of you. You know, working at home on a screen for 10 or 11 hours a day and then going to a book afterwards, it just became too much. And then in the autumn last year, I just drew breath, start again, and thought, new year, and I've raced through books this year, and I've enjoyed a huge amount.
Just finally, before you go then, any tips for reading lots of books over the summer? Anything you could do? Don't go on a beach, I would say, because it's not a good place to read books.
No, it's not. It's not. Find somewhere shady. Relax and enjoy what you're reading. Don't try and rush through them.
Yeah, I think also be brutal. You know, if the book does not spark joy, as Marie Kondo says, chuck it out.
You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, a podcast brought to you thanks to subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times, with me, Stig Abel, and my guests Robbie Millen and Andrew Holgate, literary editor at The Times and The Sunday Times, respectively. You can read more of their work at thetimes.co.uk or, of course, in print. And you can catch me every Monday to Thursday from 6 o'clock in the morning on Times Radio Breakfast. The producers were Brenna Daldorf and Marilyn Rust. The executive producer is Poppy Damon, and sound design was by John Nichols. If you'd like to get in touch with any ideas for future episodes or any thoughts on what you've just heard, then please do drop us an email to storiesofourtimes@thetimes.co.uk. See you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.